Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist. You'll find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we are all about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which is at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are hard to predict, sometimes even hard to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead and that will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you doing?
Well, I'm super fantastic. How are you?
I am excellent. Excellent. Doing great.
You know, people who listen to the show, I wish we could keep a recording of the final 30 seconds before the announcement that we're about to go live comes on. It's always, you know, especially back in the days when Michael Darling would always try to slip something in right at the very, like, final second before the before they actually start picking up our audio.
He would try to crack us up and, you know, get us off base right before the show starts. He made that kind of a habit, and that was kind of fun.
But what you've done now here, I have to say, is you've totally left me hanging. So, violating all protocol, you owe me the end of a "So I Married an Axe Murderer" story, and I think we need to go there before we do anything else.
Okay. So Phil Hartman is as a guard at Alcatraz in the movie "So I Married an Axe Murderer," and his story that he tells to the main characters in that movie is just, well, it's grotesque in so many ways that it's not family fair. I can't repeat
oh,
it.
Oh, it's not something we can say. That's why you were trying to squeeze it in there before the show started.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway,
I'll have to YouTube it, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. All I can say is there's lots of good reasons to watch So I Married an Axe Murderer, and the scene at Alcatraz is just one of them with Phil Hartman. Of course, he was always great.
Phil Hartman, yeah, one of the all-time great Phils. One of the all-time great Phils of all time.
That's right. He's in the top two.
Right up there with Dr. Phil, I think. blows Phil Donahue straight out of the water, as far as I'm concerned.
I was including our own Phil in there somewhere, but he's a great Phil.
Oh, yeah, that guy, I'd put him in the top five anyway. Modesty prevents me from saying exactly which number, but somewhere in the top five. Well, hey, we got a lot of cool stuff to do this evening. In fact, we have more cool things to do than I thought we did going in, and I thought we had plenty because, let's face it, Stephen has become a big Twitter fiend. So talk a little bit about what we're going to be doing tonight.
Okay, well, here's the deal. Here's what inspired me. I was reading over Makers again. If you haven't heard our show with Cory Doctorow from about a couple of months back, it's a great one. Cory was a very good guest, but we had read just prior to him coming on the show the book Makers, and so I was just rereading it because I enjoyed it so well. And Twitter is kind of a big part of it because a journalist is in the book and she is tweeting a lot of the activity that's going on in the book. And so I thought, you know, I really got to try this Twitter thing out. It's only been out like years, and you know, we were on the cutting edge of podcasting, Phil. I mean,
sure.
We were podcasting before we knew to call it that, you know.
That's right.
But here it is, you know, we're into, you know, tweeting has been around at least what, 4 years or something like that. So
at least a couple. Yeah, at least two. It's amazing how fast
you've been tweeting a little bit, but I mean,
I've had a Twitter feed for about a year and a half, but you know what? I've never gotten into the groove. You know what I mean?
It's like once every month you might throw out a tweet. You know, I mean,
yeah.
So if your world is hanging on tweets from Phil, I'm sorry.
Twitter would not survive if all the tweeters were like me. It just
that's right.
It would go nowhere.
So anyway, I jumped in with both feet, and I've got like, 30 plus tweets that we could use and talk on each an hour. So obviously we can't do that. So here's what we're going to do. I'm going to throw a tweet into the chat room, and if it produces any kind of interesting discussion from you guys in the chat room at all, you know, we'll mention it. Otherwise, we're just going to go on. We're going to keep on with the regular show as scheduled. And so this is kind of, you guys contributing to the content portion of the show. So
we rely on our friends in the chat room, I think, a lot to provide the commentary that we respond to and that makes the show more fun and more interactive as we go. But we're taking it up a notch tonight. We're feeding them some we're feeding them some fresh meat here, some content that we're not actually talking about unless folks, friends in the chat room, unless you do something about it. Okay, so it's all up to you. Meanwhile, we're going to carry on with the show that was planned, and we will weave in and out of the topics that were listed at the Speculist and on the Fast Forward Radio site. Any discussion that comes up around tweeting. Right now I see that, you know, everyone's the real buzz in the chat room is Sally's new computer. Congrats on the new computer, Sally. We're glad you were able to retrieve all your information. Sally had a big crash last week, and that's why she wasn't with us. So glad you got that sorted out. So our topic this evening is going to be possible futures. That was how I described that in the blog post as I wrote it. And what we're talking about here is just narrowing down a few. We've talked about the age of possibility before, and I talk about practical time travel and possibility space. But I think it's important when we're considering all these incredible changes that the world is going through, how many interesting possibilities there are, very plausible possibilities there are for the future. Ideas that may have been kind of stock science fiction ideas all of our lives are real possibilities for the future. There are things that that we can look at now and see potential developments that might be pushing us in that direction. So I actually put a list of those together, and the possibilities that I listed were the dawn of teleportation, the triumph of machines over human beings in the workforce, the privatization of space exploration, the introduction of brain backup technology, and the discovery of life on other worlds. Now, those are, five out of, a million possible possibilities that a person could list, potentialities that could be realized. But I picked those because those are, in particular, the kinds of things, any one of those you might do a science fiction movie about, back in the 70s or 80s.
Yeah, it could be the basis of a very cool science fiction movie. Any one of them. So
absolutely. So I thought we would start with these kind of what's the word I'm looking for? Kind of high concept future possibilities that we could explore a little bit. And we'll start with the first one I mentioned, which is the dawn of teleportation. I don't know if you've followed that recent story about the 16-kilometer photon state teleportation that some Chinese scientists pulled off just about, within the last week or so. I know that Instapundit and Kurzweil.net both picked it up. But the headline here is, "Beam Me Up, Data Teleported Over Record 16 Kilometers. A group of Chinese scientists has successfully achieved teleportation up to 16 kilometers using quantum entanglement of photons." Now, this is really interesting because I think in the time that we've been doing the Speculist, we have probably had at least one major teleportation headline a year. Is that fair to say?
Yeah.
One a year, going back to about 03, 04, whenever it was that we got started. So this is not brand new news when you see something like this. The record here is that rather than just a few feet or across a room, this time, we've gotten some distance. 16 kilometers, what's that going to equal out to about 10 miles, something like that.
And the thing that always blows me away about this is because these things are apparently instantaneous. When you have, when you've got quantum entanglement and something happens to one thing that's entangled, it happens to the other simultaneously. But somehow that doesn't mess up, causation. There's not a problem with it beating the speed of light. I'm not sure that I quite understand that, how that works. But it's been explained to me about a half dozen ways, and it's just not getting through. For whatever reason, I'm not able to grasp that concept quite yet.
I don't get it either. Okay. Unless just plain moving faster than light doesn't in and of itself violate causation.
Well, maybe it's like it happens instantaneously, but somehow, you know, it's not actually carrying information. I'm not quite sure how that works, that it's not that, you know, for example, if I had some sort of quantum communicator and I'm on Mars and you're on Earth and we're able to talk back and forth with no lag, how is that not, somehow violating relativity and the speed of light limitation on information? I'm not sure how that would work or not work.
Well, it's really interesting. When you look at what they did, to your point, they've got photons, photons at point A, entangled with photons at point B, 16 clicks away. So
right.
we change the state, the quantum state of the photons over here in A, and instantaneously they're changed over there on B. Now, I think that's information traveling. It's got to be. That quantum state is, to me, information. The question is, could you encode any information into doing that? And as I read this article, it seems like they talk around whether that would be possible. In fact, it feels more like it probably wouldn't be possible. One of the paragraphs reads, a teleported phone call, although no faster than a regular one, would be impenetrable, and eavesdropping on a teleported phone call would be impossible. The research could also dramatically speed up computing power. So I think that it's almost like one of those, like, oh, what a ripoff, right? Because it's like, yeah, stuff's moving faster than light, but I think effectively any encoded information was somehow going to hit that speed of light barrier, right? So even if you and I had a quantum telephone, a teleportation-based phone conversation between here and Mars, the fastest the information could get from you to me and back would be at the speed of light.
So
why that is, I don't know. But I think that's
a 20-minute lag. Or
yeah, you'd still have the 20-minute lag, same as if we were using radio waves. Yeah.
Yeah.
However,
I'm not
the
quite
signal
sure how
would be
or why
perfect.
That works. Yeah.
The signal would be perfect.
That's right.
Yeah, I don't know why either.
Because
ultimately what you want is it's not just the quantum state of a few photons that you want to be able to move, right? You want to be able to transmit the quantum state of, like, an entire object, right? So you can say, here's this cup of coffee. I'm going to entangle matter over here in point B on Mars and replicate that quantum state between here and there. And maybe it would be a destructive process of getting all those quantum states. So you would effectively, like Star Trek, send the coffee cup from here to Mars. Now, if that could only happen at the speed of light, Sheldon would say, bazinga, right? Awesome. it feels like a bad deal if you can't communicate faster than light. But man, if we could, transport matter anywhere at the speed of light, that would be really cool. And then we run into the question of, well, what if you did it, what if you aimed that destructive quantum state passing beam at a human being and sent the human being at the speed of light from point A to point B? We get into that whole interesting discussion about whether we come along for the trip or not. But if we stop short of that, it's like, yeah, it's kind of a ripoff on the traveling faster than the speed of light thing, But it's very promising in terms of the traveling as fast as the speed of light thing. And frankly, traveling as fast as the speed of light, or even being able to move objects at the speed of light, is a pretty enticing possibility. And it's one that we're a long way away from, but we're a bit closer to now than we were before.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I guess, should we, go over the plausibility of these outcomes? I mean,
We absolutely can, sure. So let's do it in stages. We want to talk about a quantum computer or a quantum communication device that relies on teleportation technology. What would you say the plausibility of that is?
Okay, I think those are two different things. Quantum computer and quantum communication are two different things. And I think quantum communication probably be the first, we get that first.
Okay.
And then quantum computers would follow shortly thereafter. Then quantum teleportation of actual physical things would come much after that. I think you'd almost have to have a quantum computer in order to handle quantum teleportation. So I guess I would give the likelihood of those, a high likelihood to communication and maybe slightly less likely to have a quantum computer. Although it seems like, basically, we've heard a couple of things about very very simple quantum computers already being used. So, being experimented with. So, I don't know. High likelihood for that as well. Teleportation much less likely.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
I agree that teleportation of matter is farther down the road. I think it is perfectly plausible in a theoretical sense. I have no idea what the technology would be that would get you there, but I agree that it would take a massive amount of computing power, unlike anything we currently have, to pull something like this off. Now, Ken has come right out and said teleportation 120 years away, going on the record there in the chat room. And I assume Ken is talking about teleportation of matter and of people, because, teleporting people is kind of the, pardon the expression, final frontier for teleportation.
Oh,
and
perhaps Ken is looking at the timeline of the Star Trek universe, it is, 120 years from now, that'll be invented. Yeah, so there you go.
Can I sidebar something? Do you know, we figured out that my baby daughter is probably about the same age as Sephram Cochran.
She's born the same year.
Yeah, well, roughly, I just got to talking about how, well, yeah, she's going to be, she'll be about his age come the 2060s, right, when Star Trek First Contact takes place. And I said, wait a minute, she's like Sephram Cochran's age. I just thought that was kind of interesting.
Probably run into him at the nursery, so anyway.
They could be buds. Well, and her name is Sephra. There was nothing intended there, but, come on. I'm just
throwing
it up.
It's pretty close.
It's pretty darn close. Also, Sally raised a very
interesting... Sally disagrees with me. She thinks that the quantum computer is we're on top of the quantum computer even now, but that quantum communications is much further away. So we'll see.
Yeah, I would actually agree with Sally on that, although what we're doing with quantum computing right now is still fairly primitive, and one might argue that this experiment was very primitive quantum communication. So, for what it's worth, I think those two actually go together fairly closely, and that we might be trading back and forth between them until we get something that really, it's not, to me, it's not a quantum computer until it does something that like a regular computer can't do, right? Because what's the point? you can do something really amazing with it. It doesn't really matter if it's a quantum computer or not. same with a quantum phone. But and Sally points out that children today would be about the same age as Spock's father. Well, there you go. Okay. So your kids, potentially, there, Stephen.
Yeah, that's right. About the same.
I'm about the same age. Okay. Let's see. What was our next? I've been talking about my child growing up to live in the Star Trek universe, which is possible, but I'm not going to throw that one out there as a that's almost a past future kind of a possibility.
Right. How about the triumph of
yeah, go ahead.
Gene over human beings in the workforce? So this is something we've actually talked about a couple times here recently.
We have indeed, and in fact, I had it on the list of things to talk about last week, but did we get to it or not? I don't recall if we did.
We really didn't get to it last week, so let's talk about it now. We had a guest, Martin Ford, who had written a book, The Light in the Tunnel, The Lights in the Tunnel. And basically, the whole premise of the book is that due to automation and increased productivity in using machines, that slowly, wealth becomes concentrated in fewer and fewer individuals until the economy basically just sort of winks out. We don't have much of an economy anymore. And so, anyway, that was his and. It's a thought that really me and Phil too, right? I mean,
it's a bummer. I mean,
it's a real bummer.
Bummer, dude. But the thing about that scenario is it's one that I'm immediately predisposed, to disagree with in a very knee-jerk way because there's immediate arguments I have about that. Well, that's a Luddite position. That's that's what people have always said, blah, blah, blah. The thing is, when you read Martin's book, he talks about all that. He says, yeah, I know, people will say this is a Luddite position, and I know people have always said this, but this time it's different. And, in fact, one of the things we talk about all the time is that, in fact, things that are happening right now are very different from anything that's ever happened before in the history of humanity. And the possibility that machines could suddenly overtake us in everything all at once, to the extent that that we no longer have any value to contribute to the economy, while I personally dislike that idea extremely, is not one I think you can rule out completely. I think there are still arguments to be made with it, and we had a pretty lively discussion with Martin when we had him on. And so, I think I gave some people the...
We continued the discussion in some ways with Cory Doctorow the following week.
We did, It was the two were very closely related, and Cory pushes automation in a slightly different direction. Although you see some of the side effects, some of the down effects that Martin talks about. But what I was going to say was, I think I gave the impression to some people that I'm completely bought into the lights in the tunnel. I'm not completely bought in. My point is, I can't completely rule it out. Which is what I'd like to do. I'd like to say no, and I actually can't say that. All I can say is, well, I hope not. But he makes a pretty strong case, a very plausible case, and we linked to this story. I linked to the story last week that Martin had actually sent me this link along with information that his book is now available for free online. We've got the link up at the Speculist for that. But the headline is HP to invest $1 billion in automation, cut 9,000 jobs. They did say tech giant also plans to hire 6,000 for sales and other positions. But that's a really interesting mathematical proposition there, right? Well, we're gonna automate sufficiently to cut 9,000 jobs. However, we're gonna hire 6,000. So the first thing you think is, well, that's not so bad, right?
It sounds like a negative 3,000 job cut.
Yeah.
Good math,
Well, 9,000 sounds really bad, but it's like, hey, hiring 6,000 sounds pretty good. But then, exactly right, Stephen. If you if you go ahead and do the math, you go, well, if they keep growing at this rate, they'll be down to zero. It won't take very many iterations, right? I mean, if they then cut 6,000 and hire 4,000, right?
The other bad thing about this, is that it's rewarded in the stock market. If you're a company and you don't like the price of your stock, fire a bunch of people. And for some reason, right now, I guess in this environment, people look at that and say, yeah, they're leaning up, and your stock price goes up.
When you look at that, that investment is not based on empathy or lack of empathy with the people losing their job. It's not based on any human emotion at all, right? It's based on just on the real simple math, right? It's like when you do the 9,000 minus 6,000. We look at it and go, they've just laid off 9,000 people. they've cut their costs significantly. Other people, it's almost like liar's poker or one of those games, right? You look and go, everybody else is going to think this is a good investment. The stock price is going to go up. I better buy some. And that itself, if nothing else, even if they're not doing anything else right, just that one act will probably drive the stock price up. Now, chances are a company like HP is doing other smart things as well because they're, you know, they're a pretty darn well run company overall. But the reality is that the less reliant a company is on what V'ger would have described as carbon based units, the more efficiently it can operate, and probably the better long term investment it is. All other things being equal. So, as harsh as it is that makes a company a good investment, you can't argue with the math, right? That's the
well, I guess not. But I mean, obviously there is a limit to it. I mean, if not, then why don't we fire everybody and let the company run on its own? Obviously, we're not to that level of automation. We need people. So, I guess
that scenario, that question, is the book, The Lights in the Tunnel, isn't it? I mean,
yeah, that's it. That's the whole thesis, isn't it?
Yeah.
If we get to the point where machines do it all, and therefore, how does the wealth generated by a company that doesn't need people anymore? How does that wealth get generated? And where does it go? And what do people do with their time once we're all sitting around going, okay, we have no jobs? So I mean, it's obviously a much different.
Well, Sally says we'll all become internet writers. So, all I can tell you is that my day job pays a little bit better currently than the speculist does. So
exactly. This is a labor of love, but love doesn't put bread on the table. So,
not right now. Anyway, we'll see. Yeah. We'll see. The economy can move in a lot of different possible directions, and I think Cory Doctorow gave us a vision of a world where I don't think he would say love will put bread on the table, but where people pursuing their interests and doing creative things actually can lead to the creation of value and kind of a continued ongoing place for people in the economy, and that's what I certainly hope turns out to be the case. And if you and I can make a couple million blogging, I think that'd be all right too. I really don't have a big problem with that.
Exactly.
A lot of
Woofie or something. Yeah, exactly.
If it's money, fine. If it's a whole lot of like credibility and reputation, that's okay too. Question from Sally, will companies cease being companies in the sense that everyone will be running their own personal business instead of large numbers of people being hired by companies? Well, that is the image of kind of the contractor nation. You see that one rolled out every now and then, where the whole idea of a firm, of an establishment, those words all talk about things being fixed in place and talk about long-term duration of things. Don't maybe have a place in the economy that is coming, that increasingly we become free agents who find work as it presents itself and do it for whoever needs it done rather than there being these big organizations. Now I don't know if that will work or not. I know that certainly in the early part of the aughts, back in 2003-2004 time frame, there was a real shift of people towards doing their own kind of cottage internet based businesses, their own selling stuff on eBay, or I've got this thing I've always wanted to do, and now I can I've got a medium that makes it possible to do that. Do we end up in a place where the whole economy shifts that way? I don't know. I would have a hard time predicting.
Well, we see a little bit of that. Those ideas are toyed around with, obviously, in the book Makers, where you've got a couple of guys living basically in a junkyard, taking old technology and making new things, new ideas, and then once they have the idea and once they've developed it, then it's put into a large system, the Codacell company, Kodak and Duracell put together.
Right.
Basically, give it to the world then, and until other competitors come in and drive down the price to the point they do go on to the next thing. So, do we all end up working in sort of independent sales of a large company? Maybe so. I don't know. Maybe that's how it goes.
Maybe independent sales of a large company. Maybe just independent sales, like single-celled organisms. Maybe just cells of one person who's out doing his own thing. And what's interesting is all those... I was just going to say, all those models currently exist today, and they have always existed, right? There are people who are just independent contractors. There are small contracting firms. There are large companies. There are medium-sized companies. There are large companies that outsource to smaller... I mean, all of those models exist. It's a question of... It's a question of whether there's going to be this mass movement towards an end of it where people haven't been before.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I was just saying, maybe instead of it being large companies, it could be, the network that you plug into when you have something great is very ad hoc. You know, it could be, instead of it, you working under one corporate logo, when you come out with something, then you just shop it, and then whoever's interested in running with it then runs with it, and then on the next idea, it might be a totally different network that's involved. So,
all,
something like that.
All good possibilities. So where do you rate the plausibility of, let's go back to the Martin Ford scenario, the economy falters due to automation scenario. Where do you rate that one in a plausibility standpoint?
50-50, but only because I hate the idea so much. It has to be wrong because I hate it so much.
Good. Well, that's the kind of rational analysis we provide on this program.
If you were to pin me down and ask me to be rational about it, I probably would have to give it a much higher probability that, we're looking at a period of time where we go through a very painful and awkward adolescence, where it's we have trouble contributing to the world that's in development around us. So,
it's interesting. I would have thought that I was going to rank it more likely than you, and you have ranked it more likely than I do. I think, and I'm talking about the total end of the economy, kind of
right.
The lights flicker out scenario, I would give that less than a 10% chance. But anything more than a 1% chance is very worrying, right? I mean, that's just not a thing that that you want to have happen at all. I agree that potential long, difficult, awkward transition stage, yeah, that's probably I'm gonna join you in the rational 50-50. That's a coin toss right there. Whether that one happens, and I think there are good reasons to think that might happen. Also, good reasons to think we might work our way around that. And I would recommend once again. I'm going to recommend this book every week until we get the author on. The Rational Optimist by Matt Ridley I think gives good reason to think that. That things might go a very different direction. I'm not gonna go into a whole description of that tonight, but if we can get Mr. Ridley on at some point, I think that would be an interesting counterpoint to all the discussions we've had on that particular topic up to this point. How about just the scenario where we all become independent, corporations of one? How plausible do you see that?
Well, I very plausible. I think we're heading in that direction already. And we can see this in the fact that more and more people, for example, are working at home. We have the ability to do more and more things with just the normal technology that people have in their homes. And also the very fact we no longer consider the possibility of starting with a company and working there for 40 years and retiring to be all that high. Most people nowadays, you move from job to job throughout your career, and that's not seen as, as being unstable. That's just kind of the way the world works now.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, we've got a comment from Spin Dave. It would be a relief listening to an optimist. Spin Dave, you have come to the right show, okay?
We are a couple of optimists.
That's what we do here. That's why we are so tortured talking about the downside stuff. It's really not our thing. And with that thought, I'm going to jump quickly to the privatization of space exploration. Now,
talk about reason for optimism. This is kind of cool. This is a cool thing that's happening.
You know what is really exciting to me about this is this is a plausible future that I always wanted to work out anyway. Okay, I mean, it's like if you could pick how you wanted it to go, do you want there to be a big Apollo-style government-sponsored space program that gets us to Mars and then builds another space station out by Saturn, and it's like 2001: A Space Odyssey and so forth? Or do you want people like the guy in The Man Who Sold the Moon by Robert A. Heinlein to get us into space? And you know, give me the choice between those two, man. I'm going with The Man Who Sold the Moon every time. Because
a lot of people, you know, when we're growing up, we admire like astronauts. But who would you rather be, Neil Armstrong or Han Solo? I mean, really? Are we all going to choose to be Han Solo? I mean, that's the world, you know, that you want. You know, you're racing around the universe, smuggling goods through the Galactic Empire or whatever with your big furry friend. That's what you do. I mean, that's the fun thing to do. Accomplishing great things for a monolithic, space program. It's great, but it's not nearly as fun, is it?
Well. And this is to take nothing away from Neil Armstrong, one of my true absolute heroes. But who had the cooler ship? Okay, I mean the Eagle, versus the Millennium Falcon. Okay, the Eagle versus the Falcon. Exactly. I gotta go with the Falcon every time. All right.
That's right.
Just as simple as that. It did 18 parsecs past light speed. Right.
Dusty asked, "Can he be Buzz Aldrin?" Yeah, especially if somebody comes up to you and says you didn't go to the moon. You want to be Buzz Aldrin. Bill, have you seen that video? You know,
I have seen
about?
That video. I love that. You know, that's a palate cleanser. If anyone has had the misfortune of seeing any of this footage of Buzz on Dancing with the Stars, please go to YouTube and look for Buzz punching the guy out who challenged him on whether he really went to the moon. Because actually, from that standpoint, they had equal wingmen, right? Chewie versus Buzz. I think you could go either way, and I think you're in good shape, right? You know,
yeah,
maybe one had a more technologically advanced ship, but they both had great sidekicks. Not that Buzz is a sidekick; he's a great astronaut and a great American in his own right. I don't mean to demean him, but please, Buzz, stay off Dancing with the Stars. What are you doing to it? Okay. anyway, moving quickly on. This is so cool. Bigelow Aerospace. We've talked about them. We've blogged about them. Initially. These guys describe themselves as building the first hotel in space, and I think they probably still have aspirations along those lines. But according to the article that we'll be linking, most recent news story about them, they've kind of been sidetracked a little bit. And Stephen, I don't know if you've read the story. Do you know what they've been sidetracked by?
Well, no. You got to tell me what's the deal?
They're pretty much providing the next generation space station that the whole world's going to use.
This is the same group that has something in orbit right now, correct?
That's right. Yeah, they're the ones
who
make
orbit now?
It's this big inflatable habitat. I mean, there's nobody in it, right? But they did a proof of concept and sent one up, and sure enough, it works. They're the guys who make the big floating orbital balloons, and the founder of the company, Robert T. Bigelow. He's actually, he's an entrepreneur, made his money in, one of the budget hotel chains. I can't think of which one. But he's now pumped more than $100 million into this project. He had this dream. He had this idea of putting a hotel in space. And now he's got contracts with other countries who basically they want to have their own space station, so he's going to put up like the next generation international space station. And between between his offering the location out in space and others who are going to be providing payload launch capability, you basically got this totally revitalized worldwide space program being provided not by governments. Governments are going to be, you know, purchasing the services, but they're going to be purchasing them from businesses who, of course, are working on making things as lean and efficient and safe as they possibly can. So it's like this completely new model of getting into space that has emerged, and very interestingly, has emerged out of the announcement, I guess, what, 6 months ago, not even 6 months ago, that our new space program, our new trip to the moon has been canceled. We're not doing that. We're not going there. The government's not doing that. And President Obama said, instead, we're going to roll out this privatized approach to getting into space, and looks like the idea is really taking off.
Yeah, and I just got to say, from bravo, President Obama. I don't have the opportunity to say that too often, so I'll say it now. That's I'm completely in agreement with that, and so there you have it.
We were still giving him cups, he's finally earned his cup, huh?
That's right. He's earned his speculous cup.
Speculous coffee mug. I'll see if I can find one of those and send it to the president. I don't know. He probably can't take gifts now. We'll send it to Buzz Aldrin.
Yeah, something I think is hilarious about all this is that, you know, the remember the hotel that originally wanted to put a space station up? They wanted the first hotel group that wanted to have anything to do with space and was even considering that. I mean, way back in the 60s, it was can you name the hotel? It was Hilton. Hilton,
yeah.
What is this, Paris's grandfather or somebody like that?
Right, that's right. This was actually a subplot on Mad Men last season.
Yeah, so, oh, okay, well, that's cool.
Yeah, he was one of the clients of the advertising agency. He's like, hey, I want a hotel on the moon. Yeah.
Yeah, and so Hilton had this dream, and he said, and basically he had said at some point, you know, basically he had gotten his accountants in, and they had sat down and put pen to paper or whatever, and pencil to paper, and come up with the idea, well, if we can ever get launch capability of, you know, a certain number of dollars to a certain number of pounds, we'll do it. And that never happened. Not with monolithic government space programs could they ever get it to where it was cheap enough to put enough poundage in orbit to build a Hilton hotel. So now instead of a Hilton, maybe it'll be Motel 6 or whoever. Whatever group now is, apparently it's a very discount hotel chain or motel chain that's showing interest now. So,
well, if I could find it, it's somewhere in this article. It says which. But how interesting that it's hotel guys who push us in this direction. You know, I mean that Hilton had the vision back in the 60s, and now Bigelow is actually making this happen here in the 21st century is just really pretty amazing. There must be something about the vision of people who run hotel chains.
Yeah.
So anyway, this is one, you know, this is one I think that we'll have no problem gauging the plausibility of. Wouldn't have before either. I think it's just a matter of how long it's going to take. What are the chances that ultimately space exploration, space settlement becomes largely a private matter? I would say they're about 99% or better.
Absolutely. If it's going to happen at all. If we're going to leave the planet in any significant numbers or you know, use outer space in any significant way, it's going to have to be by way of business. Business is going to have to do it. It's, you know, we as nations are not going to fund the dead ends that we've had so far with space exploration. I mean, it's just there's not enough return on investment. And we've, you know, basically that we've been down that road, and I don't see that's going to be the way it continues by and large. So,
yeah, well, and I think that the history of exploration and settlement probably has consistently followed that model anyway. You start out with these ships that, you know, look at how the Western Hemisphere was opened, right? Those were initial exploration were pretty much government funded. And then the private sector steps in, and then it's just individual people going to find a new life, a better life in a new place. I think that that we'll probably see a very similar pattern. in broad strokes. Obviously, it'll be completely different in terms of the technologies that are being used and the motivations that, that people have for doing it. But yeah, I think we're in full agreement that this becomes a pretty much purely not purely, but predominantly private affair. I think in the fairly near future. I think we're heading in that direction now.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well,
I'm throwing out tweets and I'm getting no response in the chat room. You guys have got to got to jump on board these things.
Yeah. Well, they're listening. You know what? I think they're listening.
Yeah. It's weird. Hopefully, that's what's happening.
They're listening to the show. Well, because sometimes it's like you look in the chat room, and this was especially true back in the Michael days, I have to say, but you'd look in the chat room, and the conversation going on there appeared to have nothing whatever to do with what we were talking about. And, you know, and here we are trying to make that happen, and everybody's being pretty, you know, they're following us pretty well. So
I guess we shouldn't complain.
This is how we learn, right? Okay, our next possible future, the introduction of brain backup technology. And I would direct your attention to a story in New Scientist called Immortal Avatars, Back Up Your Brain, Never Die. And interesting story about attempts that are currently underway for people to create digital reflections, digital shadows. They're really not digital versions yet, but some kind of digital replica of themselves. Obviously, the technology that would allow us to attempt something like this is much better today than it has been at any time in the past. But as I read this article, my first thought is, we still got a long way to go. I mean, there are people who are on the cutting edge of this, and they're spending thousands of dollars, you know, getting a nice image done and filling out these questionnaires saying, you know, on a scale from 1 to 10, you know, how much do you agree or disagree with this statement? It'd be something like, I like to help others. I thousands of these statements, and you're putting all these in, so they're creating this, like, personality profile. You're getting all your interests listed, and you're adding all these facts, and you've got these avatars interacting with each other, and slowly but surely it's sort of evolving into this to this replica of you. Well, I think it's heroic work they're doing. It's brilliant pioneering work. My guess is this will probably lead someplace completely unexpected. I don't know that we're going to get replicas of people along these lines. I'm not sure what we will get.
What I think, Phil, is this is very, very important for the world at large, okay?
Mm-hmm.
In that when someone dies, I mean, when somebody dies, they take so much with them.
Right.
You know, it could be history. It could be – but also, I mean, it's just – the work that somebody does and that the place, the function they fulfill in society, you know, obviously the moment they're gone, they're gone. I mean, that's, and someone else has to step up, and it's pretty jarring, isn't it? When you lose a key person in whatever enterprise it is. What if you had an avatar that to some extent could, you know, if not do the work, maybe help train the replacement after somebody dies? That is, to me, that's important work. Now, the big deal here, obviously, is that we don't make the trip. You know, I mean, if we got this great avatar Phil that's so good that actually we can continue doing fast forward radio after you're gone, Phil, you know, that you still, you know, that poor Phil, we don't have him. You know, he didn't make the trip. We've got Phil the avatar, you know.
Well, that's cool, because the avatar could be here doing this while I'm off on my retirement cruise, right? I mean, wasn't that
– Exactly. That would be better, wouldn't it? So,
yeah, I'm off exploring the universe on my near light speed, and I'll come back. It'll be 80,000 years later, and Avatar Phil will have evolved into, like, this, you know, solar system-spanning intelligence that – sorry, we've digressed just slightly, but – well. I think you're right, though, and this is what John Smart talked about when we had him on the show, and in fact, when I've talked with him before, this is something that he points out that is incredibly important, and people don't see the importance of it because they're focusing on that next step, which is uploading the whole person, creating a pure digital copy of the person, and then you've got that whole question of how do you make the leap, how do you get that actual consciousness, how do you transfer the consciousness in there. Interesting problem, huge philosophical issue to deal with, something we talk about all the time, but actually one step past what we're talking about here, which is you know, it's like creating the ultimate scrapbook. It's like creating the ultimate reservoir of knowledge about somebody that would still be of use to the people who are left behind after that person's not with us anymore. And you know, there's personal information, there's family history, there's just the ability to feel like you're interacting with that person in a sense, the ability to feel like that you've got some remnant of the experience of being with that person that could still be kept, that would still be possible, and that this sort of technology would allow. And so I agree, just you know, not only from the professional standpoint, because I think it would be tremendously helpful for business. I think it'd be tremendously helpful for education. But I also think it'll be important to people in their personal lives. I think that that friends and family will make use of this as a way of kind of holding, you know, the way we do scrapbooks and photo albums and things like that today.
Absolutely. Well, I'm thinking of people that really, really need avatars. Steve Jobs jumps to mind. You know,
there you go.
You know, you talk about a company that it seems like every time he leaves Apple, it kind of drifts. You know, and then he comes back and Apple does amazing things for whatever reason. You know, maybe he's just been really lucky, or maybe he really is that big of a genius. I think a fully functioning Steve Jobs avatar for after his retirement would be pretty important, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. Well, and you think about somebody like Ray Kurzweil.
Here's
a guy who delivers his presence digitally all the time anyway. I was just, you and I had talked about or swapped emails about the fact that the world premiere of The Singularity Is Near is going to be up in Breckenridge on Saturday. I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to make it or not. That's kind of a haul up there, and I would pretty much take my entire day if I'd like to. I'm going to be on a business trip the following week. I got to think about, you know, spending time with family and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, but you'd have the opportunity to meet and visit with Ray Kurzweil about his movie. Well, I mean, he's going to be there and
Well, that's exactly it. I'm not sure he will be there. I think that he will be there via telepresence because I think, if I'm not mistaken, either the same day or the following day, he's speaking at the H+ Summit at Harvard. So, and I know he's going to be live there. So I think Ray is doing his usual trick of showing up in virtual presence at the world premiere.
Maybe so. But that's not what I read, though, Phil. I read that he was out.
I don't know. I was just looking at it today, and it said, because I got to thinking about this, and it said it's a chance to have which isn't to say you can't have a conversation with him, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Follow-up discussion with Ray Kurzweil. I'm just not sure Ray's actually going to be there. But anyway, I'd like to go. The interesting thing is about that, think about it, does it make any difference if the person is there or if he's there via telepresence?
That's right. If you really do get the opportunity to visit with Ray about his movie after you see, I mean, yeah, it would be cool either way, wouldn't it? In fact, in some ways, it would be cooler.
It would just be so appropriate,
that,
you know?
Yeah, appropriate that he's not there, you know, physically. So, yeah, pretty neat.
Cool stuff, yeah. So anyway, he's a guy who has kind of pioneered that virtual presence sort of a thing. He's a guy, I think. And touch wood, hope it doesn't happen. Hope he's with us. Hope he lives to see it and hits escape velocity. But he's actually a guy who, a few years from now, he could be no longer with us, and we might not know about it for a long time, right? Because there'd be enough virtual Ray Kurzweil presence around that that we wouldn't even know he was gone. But hopefully that won't be the case.
Absolutely,
we'll have. Both Ray and lots of interesting virtual versions of him for years to come. Okay, so plausibility, Stephen, of the which future were we on? Virtual brain backups. What do you think?
I think it's very, very plausible. And you know what we're talking about, obviously, is avatars of ourselves, and I think it's basically. This is going to be how we begin to interact with our computers. Our computers will interact with us so intimately in working back and forth with computers on a daily basis that they begin to take on our characteristics to the point that an avatar is built automatically. It's not something we sit down and, oh, time to build the avatar today. No, I think it's just as we're doing our work, as we're living our lives, and we spend more and more of that digitally, that it'll happen automatically. So there you are.
I think so too. I give it a very high possibility. Okay, we're almost out of time. I'm going to jump to the last one. Here's the headline: Have we discovered evidence for life on Titan? Recent results from the Cassini mission suggest that hydrogen and acetylene are depleted at the surface of Titan. Both results are still preliminary, and the hydrogen loss in particular is the result of a computer calculation and not a direct measurement. However, the findings are interesting for astrobiology. Heather Smith and the author, Chris McKay, in a paper published 5 years ago, suggested that methane-based rather than water-based life, organisms called methanogens on Titan could consume hydrogen, acetylene, and ethane. The key conclusion of that paper, last line of the abstract, was the results of the recent Huygens probe could indicate the presence of such life by anomalous depletions of acetylene and ethane, as well as hydrogen on the surface. So 5 years ago, these folks write a paper and say, you know, if we ever get there, if we can run a test and we suddenly see, for no apparent reason, depletion of acetylene and ethane, as well as hydrogen, in the atmosphere of Titan, that would be suggestive of methane-based life. And sure enough, those depletions are, in fact, occurring. So, you know, this is not the dramatic, you know, mothership landing on the White House lawn of science fiction, but this is one of the more solid bits of evidence for life outside the planet Earth that has yet surfaced.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, I guess as far as plausibility goes, I guess the question is, how plausible is it that what we're seeing will turn out to be life on Titan? I would give it probably a 30 or 40% probability. I mean, of course, I'm just completely guessing here. There's so much that we don't know that it's hard to say. But you know, we have had in the past, you know, situations where it looked like we were, you know, about to be able to announce that life outside of planet Earth had been found. You know, think of the rock from Mars. And there are scientists that are still working on that haven't given up on that as a sign of life. It's pretty much been backed off of that particular instance. So, I would give it about 30-40% probability it'll turn out to be life, and it will be very interesting life, because it's gonna be something based on some. It's not carbon based at all. It's gonna be something so totally different that it'll sure be interesting to learn about.
Well, I think it's still carbon based. It's just not water based. It's methane based instead of water. It's still organic, and so ultimately going back to carbon, but.
I love what Ben Dave said. You're not going to want to offer methane-based life a cigarette.
There you go. You want to be real careful about that. I think that it's what you legal types call circumstantial evidence, but it's intriguing circumstantial evidence. So we'll follow that one closely. But anyway, there's your five plausible possible futures. And the thing I wanted to say about that before we say goodnight is that, as we've indicated, these are all current news stories. Are these futures, or is this the world that's actually unfolding around us? It looks to me like it's pretty close to that.
Yeah, and does all this pan out? No, but it's going to be a pretty interesting world, even if a couple of these things pan out. So
these are all science fiction movie plots, and every single one of them has a case being made right now that it's actually happening. So
exactly.
Interesting times we live in. Okay, Stephen, very quickly, what's our music tonight?
Okay, very quickly, I wanted to mention also. Here at my house, we're about to watch Through the Wormhole with Morgan Freeman on the Science Channel, and it looks like it's going to be interesting. We can talk about it next week. But for music tonight, it Feels Like Rock and Roll from Jeff Roney.
Jeff Roney with Feels Like Rock and Roll. Folks, we will not be on at the usual time next week. Watch The Speculist. Watch Fast Forward Radio for an announcement. We'll let you know when the show's going to be. Thanks for being with us. We have enjoyed doing it, and we look forward to being with you at some point. Again, next week. Until then, live to see it.